720 WGN.
Welcome in, everybody. It's Karen Conti on this beautiful summer evening. We have a great show tonight. We are going to be talking about, there's a lot of legal news this week, and I think there's some explaining that I'd like to do about what's going on with the Michael Cohen situation. When you are, can you audio tape somebody? Is that against wiretapping laws? I'm going to talk about that. We have a lot of people who ask me questions about that, and I want to explain as best I can what is legal and what is not legal when it comes to recording people. I'm also going to talk a little bit about the Manafort prosecution, which is going to start this week. Again, I don't like to get into the politics of those things. Rather, I would like to use my legal expertise to explain some of the concepts that go on that even some of the media outlets get wrong. I think some of them explain things very well, and on some issues they don't. And maybe that's because I think the media has an agenda these days, and they try to skew a little bit to make it in their favor. So I want to try to take as a neutral a position as I can from a political standpoint, but try to explain a little bit from all my years of experience what is really going on here. We're going to be talking with Justice Ann Burke from the Illinois Supreme Court about the Special Olympics, which had its heyday this weekend. It's the 50th anniversary of the games that originated in Chicago in 1968. Justice Ann Burke was the originator, along with Eunice Kennedy Shriver, and we're going to be talking about what happened in the festivities, and we're talking about a change that might come to Chicago because of the Special Olympics. Then we will be talking to a sports attorney, Jeffrey Abood, who went to the ESPY Awards and represents athletes in many matters, and we're going to talk about what it's like to represent athletes. Do they get a good shake in the courts, or do they not get a good shake in the courts? And then we, of course, are going to be talking about legal questions at 8 o'clock, as I always do. I take your legal questions on any topic. That I try to give you some guidance in the right direction. I may not have an exact answer for you, but at least I can try to help you along the way. I will give out that number, but again, I'm not taking those calls until the 8 o'clock hour, but put it in your phone, 312-981-7200. The first thing I'd like to talk about tonight is a tragic accident that you probably have all seen. It happened, I believe, on Thursday, a big news story, the tragic sinking of a duck boat during a very bad storm that came onto a lake near Branson, Missouri. 16 passengers and one crew member were killed, and except for the crew members, all of them were tourists from different areas. Here to talk about the legal side of the incident, the investigation, and what we might expect in the future is Chicago's very own Bob Clifford of Bob Clifford Law Offices. Hi, Bob. How are you?
Hi, Karen. Good evening. How have you been?
I'm doing well. I miss talking to you. I haven't seen you in a while.
Well, we don't arrive in the garage at the same time, then, I guess.
That's right. Just to give a little background on Bob Clifford, his name is synonymous with excellence in helping victims of personal injury, medical malpractice, consumer fraud. And one of the cases that you might recall was many years ago, he represented Rachel Barton, who was the violinist, who was a worldwide known violinist who was horribly injured in an accident with the Metra train. And Bob Clifford won her almost $30 million. In verdict. I know we're talking to USA Today and ABC News about this boating incident. Can you tell us a little bit about ducks, these boating vehicles, vessels, and whether they present a danger that you can see?
Well, there certainly are a lot of dangers associated with them, and you know, what a tragedy to have this happen. The ducks themselves, you know, for those of us from the Midwest, we've all gone, you know, many of us have gone up to the Dells, and, you know, we've seen these things all over. It's incredible that something like this could happen, but it speaks to the fact that they were not designed to transport consumers and citizens, because these were workhorses that were used in military service initially, and if you the sides of the ducks are not very big. They call that the freeboard, and it's real easy in shallow lakes for if the wind gets up, for the waves to get high, We all have seen that video. You had waves there of 4 to 6 feet, and these things just can't cope with that. And, you know, Karen, just this weekend you have the Mackinac Island race.
And
when you talk to those sailors, they will all tell you that one of the dangers about Lake Michigan is that it's actually a shallow body of water. And so if the wind picks up in Lake Michigan, there are very serious dangers associated with capsizing and taking on water. Well, the same phenomenon is true here. This is just a small touristy lake. I think it's 80 foot deep at its deepest. And you know, there's some, from what we're hearing, some pretty bad come out, but we're told that the boats the ducks were told to stay at the dock, and they did not do that. They went out anyway.
Well, let's talk about that, Bob, for a minute. What I read, and again, we were reading things, and we're not going to know what actually happened for a while. But my understanding that there were like 73 mile an hour winds that sort of came out of nowhere, but. You're saying that
hurricane force winds.
Yeah, so you're saying that perhaps they should have known by looking at the weather report that this was a possibility. And if that's the case, from a legal standpoint, is that a place where there might be liability placed upon?
Well, I think there's clear liability here. You know, when I was first asked about it, it was in the context of what, you know, should be done. And to my mind, these boats need to be regulated. And one of the regulations should be that before they go out, they check with the NOAA, which is the National Weather Service, to determine, you know, whether it's 30 minutes or 60 minutes. There should be criteria that guide whether or not they can or cannot leave the dock, as distinguished from being driven by their profit motive. Here, the reports were that these winds were going to be high, and they should not have been allowed to leave the pier at all. You know, the other thing that's being talked about with great fervor is whether you should or should not have had life vests. And you know, back in the late 90s, there was a bad duck accident in Seattle where people died. And one of the concerns there was that people had life jackets on, the duck was submerged, and that people were actually trapped inside because of the woof.
So Bob, just as a visual here, if the life preservers were on the individuals, they would have floated up and been kind of trapped on the roof of the duck itself. Whereas if you're in a normal boat that doesn't have a top,
that's right. Right. That's right.
That's not an issue.
However is that the word is that these boats were equipped with roofs that could be released. And in fact, I hesitate to call the guy the captain. The operator of this boat had the wherewithal to release the roof, and that's why you see people were out in the water. And also the windows here are not airtight windows or anything like that. So these windows would open, people could get out. I mean, look, you can conjure up a lot of scenarios where if you're in a car with a seatbelt on or an airbag, it's, you know, you're better off if you didn't happen to have it that moment in time. But the data is clear that you're a lot safer if you have a life vest on than if you do not. And that's the reason why when you're in an airplane, and they go brace if they're going to have a hard landing. You know, the reality is that brace, the experts will tell you, may not really help you, but it might. And you might as well take the might as opposed to nothing at all.
Right. Bob, can you hold with us? I have a few more questions for you after the break.
Sure, of course.
All right, you're listening to the Karen Conti Show. We're talking to Bob Clifford of Clifford Law Offices in Chicago. Tragic accident in Branson, Missouri, a beautiful place. Bob Clifford, you know, you're one of the top, I don't even want to say top, I think you are the top personal injury lawyers, lawyer in the country. You're responsible for some of the largest verdicts and settlements. You're a very compassionate person. You do good for the, our community by giving back, and I really appreciate you being on. What happens now? If you were to have this case, Bob, or one of the cases of one of the victims here, what do you do as an attorney to make sure your client, their interests are being protected?
Well, what you need to understand is that the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, is now in charge of the investigation, and they will control everything. So, for an example, you would normally want to hire your own investigator, but yet you don't need to really do that here because the investigators will be blocked out by the government, and that's okay. Our government is, I'm very confident in the resources and ability of the NTSB. They do a great job. The only problem will be that it takes a long time. These families won't get the results of the official investigation for at least a year. But in the meantime, there are things that the private lawyers will do. They'll have their investigators trying to gather the information that they can about the families to try to lend support and assistance to them in any regard that they can. They'll also try to be identifying the appropriate experts that will need to be retained because the government may well allow the private experts of the families to participate in some of the investigation. If there are engine breakdowns, we've heard that there was a so-called black box that's been sent to Washington. A couple of weeks ago, one of my partners went to Washington to participate in the NTSB hearing for the Amtrak case that occurred in Seattle, you may recall,
yes.
Sometime back. And so, the lawyers will be there liaisoning with the family to explain the process and the proceedings to them about, what is taking place and how to put it all in context. There'll be work that needs to be done to explore what the insurance situation is and what the facts will be that we can independently gather.
Bob,
so,
just on that point,
those kind of things.
On that point, I don't have much time, but I want to talk about insurance. Will there be enough insurance? There's so many victims here, even the people who are injured. I mean, everybody on the boat is probably going to have some sort of lawsuit, and there's going to be liability. And what? Where is this money going to come from? Do you think there's insurance that covers all this?
Early reports are that this is a company that's a large company. It's a responsible company. Hopefully they have adequate insurance. We just don't know. Sadly, as you well know, Karen, there are circumstances where the amount of loss is so vast that there's an inadequacy in the insurance. And at the end of the day, the very people who caused the harm get away with harming the people again because they can't adequately compensate them. And then when there's a shortfall, sometimes that falls on the taxpayer, and that's not right for any of us. So the lawyers will do an aggressive job, as will the government, to identify all of the responsible parties. This early on, we just don't know all of the facts. I mean, we think we do, but believe me, things change. We don't know, who last maintained the ducts. We don't know if there was some equipment failure where somebody might be responsible for that that's other than the owner. So there's a lot of things that need to be explored, and that's what will occur in the weeks ahead.
Bob Clifford, thank you so much for joining us. Bob Clifford is one of our premier personal injury lawyers. His number, 312-899-9090. And if you don't remember that number, you can always call me, and I will always connect you to one of our city's best personal injury lawyers. Thank you, Bob. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Karen. Have a good evening.
All right,
bye.
You too. This week was an interesting weekend because it was the 50th anniversary of the Special Olympics that were originated here in Chicago, and we are very pleased tonight to have on with us the originator, the person who came up with the idea 50 years ago, our Illinois Supreme Court Justice Ann Burke. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Sharon. Good evening.
You must be completely exhausted. There were so many festivities and so much going on. Was it a complete success?
It was a wonderful success, I must say. And it culminated today with me throwing out the ball at the Cubs game. So, and actually, I didn't do too bad. The catcher caught it, but I did ask him to move up, so I couldn't because I couldn't throw it so far.
Is that technically cheating? Well, we won't ask you that question.
No, we won't.
But you know, one of the things that, if you listen to our show, I talk about this a lot. Ann Burke was a PE teacher with the Chicago Park District, and she came up with the idea of having, well, basically a track meet for the athletes who were had special needs, and that was her idea, and she came to Eunice Kennedy Shriver and told her the idea. And what did Eunice say to you, Anne?
She said she liked the idea, and of course, I think she might have been dreaming about having something like this because she played games with her sister Rosemary on the lawn in Hyannisport. But then she went on to tell me, even though it was a good idea, it was totally unacceptable. And, of course, me being 23 years old, kind of a college dropout, and I was, like, mortified. But she went on to tell me, which I've remembered the rest of my life, is that it's good. But it could always be better. It could be bigger. It could be national. So that's what happened. She said, go home, rewrite your proposal. And she said, I will help you. And I said, I don't know anybody else around the country to come to Chicago. And she said, don't worry, I do. You rewrote the proposal. And I did. And the first games were on July 20th, 1968. At Soldier Field.
And now we have 172 countries that participate. We have 6 million disabled children who participate every year, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Right. And this week, as you said, was it started out actually on Monday with 25 teams from around the world coming to Chicago to play unified soccer matches, because on Friday night at Toyota Park, the winners of those heats from around the world would be playing for the World Cup. So that's the new way what we're trying to push for in the future, the next 50 years, a revolution of inclusion of people that have intellectual differences playing on the same teams with those that don't. It's really what we've been doing in Chicago for 50 years, but now there's going to be sports that are actually having combination teams.
And I have like 1 minute. I want to talk about the star and the flag. We want to add a star to the Chicago flag. Can you tell us quickly what your goal is on this?
Well, it's actually it's the movement by parents of children with learning differences. We have four stars. Two are for these four. One is for Dearborn Massacre. It's a terrible thing. The Chicago Fire. And the other two were fabulous events, the World's Fair and the Columbian Exhibition. But they were one-time events. This living star would represent Special Olympics, which has lived and the heart has beat around the world for 50 years, and it will live long after us. So the parents of Special Olympians in Chicago feel that at least one star should represent something that Chicago stands for, that has created a massive change in way we think about people with intellectual differences.
Ann Burke, thank you so much, and congratulations, and thank you for originating this, and thank you so much for participating in all the activities this weekend.
Thank you, Karen, for having me tonight. Thank you.
Are you listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN? But we're talking about other things, too. And at 8 o'clock, as usual, we will be taking your legal calls on any topic. If you have a family law question, a traffic court question, small claims, wills, trusts, I'll try to do my best to answer them. And the number here is 312-981-7200, or text to that number, 981-7200. But before we do that, we are going to be talking with Jeff Abood, who is a lawyer with the firm of Abood Law Offices that have law offices throughout the Midwest. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Karen. Thanks for having me.
Jeff concentrates his practice in criminal law and family law and has a client base that includes representing many professional athletes in their issues. He has consistently been voted a rising star, one of the top criminal defense lawyers under 40, and the best divorce lawyer by Our Detroit magazine. And I have to tell you, I said to Jeff, you are at the ESPY Awards this week. Correct?
That is correct.
Which
yeah,
is the sports awards that recognizes teams and individuals in sports. You were going there, and I said, oh, would you like to come on and do a phone interview? And you said, better yet, I'll just jump on a plane and come right to you.
Absolutely. It was a great excuse to come to Chicago. Great great to be here on your show, Carrie.
And a red eye, nonetheless. So, you know, you're doing pretty well. Of course, you're young. So.
I got a few hours of sleep.
That's good.
On the plane.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the ESPY Awards. Just a little bit. I'm not a big sports fan, so I don't know how important these things are, but tell everyone what happens at the awards.
Well, the awards, certain, as you said, certain teams and individuals are honored. They receive awards. Now, these are awards that the public votes on. It used to be, in my understanding, I believe several years ago, it used to be only the player, only the general public can vote. Now, the players themselves can vote. Other people in the sports industry can vote. So it's opened up. Now they're nominated by a certain committee, and the general public, anybody can go online and vote for who they believe is the best athlete or team worthy of this particular award.
Now, you know, compared to the Academy Awards, and the Academy Awards will drive people to go to see movies, and the same with Emmys, Grammys, and all those things. Is it really an important thing for players? How do they view the awards?
I'm not sure it's quite to the caliber in the sense of as far as the general public and everybody being as interested in it as a Grammys or Emmys, because again, as you said, you're not a huge sports fan, but so or is into it. So there are a lot of people I think are like that. But being there, it's just, I mean, it felt like you're at a super high-end award show, like a Grammys, like an Emmys. There's a red carpet, the whole deal. All the athletes are there. A lot of celebrities are there. A lot of people made appearances. Still, you know, everybody was trying to be on point with the fashion. And
right.
it was definitely interesting.
One of the people that I do like is Danica Patrick. Not that I follow NASCAR. I don't. But I just think she's cool. She's pretty. She's athletic. Well, she was the host this year, right?
Absolutely, yeah. She's got it all going on.
She does.
She kept the audience fully engaged. She had some funny movie clips that were pre-taped also. She roasted some people. She told a lot of jokes. It was definitely, I think it caught everybody by surprise. It wasn't really what people were expecting from Danica Patrick at the show. It was definitely interesting.
Now, I looked this up, that Tiger Woods was the biggest, he has won the most ESPYs over the years, like 21 or something.
Uh-huh.
During the course of the awards, were there any surprises, like where you said, oh, wow, I'm surprised this athlete got the award, the team got the award?
Not really. I think we kind of predicted most of the people that received the awards. I think some of the surprises actually happened on the commercial breaks that people didn't see on TV. Some of the athletes that came up and started singing on the spot and sounded like they could have record deals themselves. It was incredible.
Oh, the outtakes are always the best.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. But I personally had a hard time sitting still for the full 3 hours, as opposed to watching it on TV,
right?
To be there in the show.
Now, there was a moment, there were a couple moments that I heard about. There was a Jimmy V Award, and what's the guy's name that it was named for? Is it Valvera? But he is Valvano, I think his name is. And he had cancer, and he was a sports commentator and a coach. The winner this year was a guy named Jim Kelly, and I'm going to play a little of the segment that went viral. Because it was very motivating. He himself, I believe, had cancer, and he was talking about persevering. Can you play that, Ashley?
I came up with a saying, make a difference today for someone who is fighting for their tomorrow. When I look across this arena and when I talk to people, I look up here, you don't need to be a Russell Wilson, an Aaron Rodgers to make a difference out there. Every single person in this room can be a difference maker.
So it was, and he had some cancer issues, right?
Cancer in his jaw. This is his third time with it back.
Wow.
Yeah, I just, you know, even just talking about it now and hearing his voice again, I had chills run through my body. It was, there were a lot of, I'm sure a lot of other people experienced that, and there were a lot of tears, but it was just an incredible man, incredible story.
Yeah, it really is, and I encourage anyone to Google it. It's on YouTube. It's just, it does send chills up your spine. The other thing that was very interesting was the Arthur Ashe Courage Award. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this year, the recipients of that were the patients of Larry Nassar, the physician at Michigan State, and for the U.S. Olympics, the one that sexually assaulted several of his patients. There were actually, you know, around 300 victims in that case, and survivors, as we call them now. And I was fortunate enough to be able to represent some of those women in achieving a settlement against Michigan State University.
So they a lot of them appeared on the stage and were acknowledged. Tell me what it was like to represent the victims in this.
I got to tell you, it was challenging because a lot of them at first were hesitant to, and I think that's why I believe they received the Courage Award, because it did take their courage and them stepping forward and coming out. A lot of them that we had talked to, prospective clients and other survivors, were hesitant. They were worried how it's going to affect their professional career, how they would be perceived. And I think that's why a lot of these young women had held back on it for so long. And some of them were telling people, and they just weren't believing them at all. And so it was a matter of showing them that you know, some sort of justice can be served, at least in the sense to make sure this is not going to happen again. But unfortunately, as we're seeing now, it has been happening in other places as well.
I mean, we saw one in Ohio State. Apparently, there was a doctor who was perhaps doing something similar. I believe he committed suicide, but the investigation is going to go on. And you advised me of another one in California.
Yeah, also Tyndall, I believe, was the name in the University of Southern California, a gynecologist. And I think I read that it could be as many as 10,000 women that he sexually assaulted.
My goodness.
During the scope of his practice.
It's staggering. Yeah. Now, the case in Michigan State was settled. Is that right?
The one against Michigan State, now against USA Olympics, is still ongoing. But we were able to achieve a settlement of an amount of $500 million against Michigan State, which I believe is the largest sexual harassment settlement. And I believe there's $80 million of that, approximately, I believe, is being reserved for any future claims that from victims that come forward.
Okay, so that how does that get divided up among the victims? Is that another process?
It is another process. There are mediators involved in that, and there's a certain scale, and depending on, I believe, the damages, I think it's going to range somewhere between $400,000 and $2 to $3 million per survivor.
Now, when you're dealing with the victims that you represented, and we had one on the air when it was going on, a woman who had a connection to Chicago, a very brave woman who described what happened and how it affected her over the years. It was very, very moving. Do you think that the publicity attendant to this helped those people, the ability to speak out to the judge, the ability to speak out with those victim impact statements, the ability to listen to other women, or the amount of money that they're receiving to acknowledge, at least, not that that's going to take away their pain or what happened to them, but at least an acknowledgement that it happened. Are all those things helpful to the victims?
Yes, I think it all helped. So I think for what Judge Aquilina, and by the way, I did see Judge Aquilina was at the awards. She had a great show up front and center, and she was receiving great applause, and several people were coming by to thank her for what she did in this case. But I think that by her allowing each one of the victims, each one of survivors, to make an impact statement in the sentencing, I was there in the sentencing of Larry Nassar's criminal case, and it just went on for days because she allowed every single one to make a statement.
Right.
And I think that helped in the healing process for each one of these girls to be able to confront him and tell their story, these young women. And also, I believe it helped, but the media attention, everything that was brought, helped. Ultimately, I think it did help in negotiating a resolution with Michigan State, and Michigan State wanted to do, you know, it seems like they were hesitant at first, but obviously I think they did what they believe was right.
The whole world watched it and were so riveting that You're right. I think from a PR standpoint, if not from a moral standpoint, they probably realized they needed to do some damage control here. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. I'm talking with Jeffrey Abood, and we're talking about sports and representing athletes, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that when we return. Here. I am talking with Jeffrey Abood. We're talking about representing, being a lawyer and representing athletes in different aspects of their lives. Jeffrey, thank you for joining us. Thank you for taking the red eye here to Chicago to join me. And I think you're almost awake, which is good. That's good. So you represent athletes from the NHL, the NFL, the NBA in criminal law and family law matters. Is it any, and of course you represent people in other walks of life besides professional athletes.
Absolutely.
So is there a difference in how you face representing somebody who may be charged with a DUI, say, who's a professional athlete? Is that a different representation?
I don't know that there's necessarily a difference. We tend to handle all the cases the same way. What's unique to when a professional athlete gets in trouble is that the media is usually all over it. So that sometimes, unfortunately, alters the way a prosecutor might want to handle the case and could potentially affect the judges sometimes. Now, fortunately, we've seen judges make the right decision in those cases, regardless of that media attention on the case.
So when you're saying, let's be real specific here, the prosecutor you think is going to prosecute harder because the prosecutor wants to make a name, maybe for him or herself, or make a point here that the law applies equally to professional athletes?
That could be the case, and that sometimes is the case.
Because I think a lot of the public thinks that professional athletes and maybe celebrities get a better deal, not a worse deal.
Well, I'll tell you, I haven't really necessarily experienced that. It's been equally as hard or even harder. And a lot of times when the media is involved, it is a lot harder that we have to work to be able to achieve good results for our clients.
Well, and I look at these athletes, and they're a commodity to the teams. I mean, they're not only their ability to draw fans, to win games, but also to sell shoes and those types of things. So to damage that product is it's a valuable issue. It's worth a lot of money. And how does that affect how you represent them?
Well, there's a lot of dynamics here. That particular individual is our client. However, they also have their agents that get very involved because they have an interest in it. And then the NBA Players Association sometimes gets involved as well. The specific teams do. The president, the managers of the specific teams all get involved in those type of cases because, as you said, they're a commodity and there's a lot of dollars. Each game could be several hundred thousands of dollars. And a lot of times when an athlete is convicted or does plead guilty to a crime of some sort, then the professional organization, whether it be the NBA or NFL or NHL or MLB or whatever it is, they are going to have their own review as well, and they can have their own punishment as well. And it usually includes a suspension of a certain number of games, and that equals a lot of dollars.
So the criminal result may drive what happens from a sports standpoint.
It does. It does a lot of times, absolutely. So there's not only representation in the court, but there's also representation with their league.
And, you know, I look at how sensitive everyone is now, and I'm not saying it's good or bad, but you have Roseanne Barr saying something, and she loses her show, and you have people saying things or laughing at jokes, and they lose their show. I assume that this happens in athletics now. I mean, I remember it was Ray Rice, who the NFL guy, who slapped his wife in an elevator in a hotel. And, you know, it was a big uproar. And, you know, maybe before that wouldn't have been a big deal, but now it's a very, very big deal.
I mean, listen, athletes need to, and this drives me crazy about a lot of athletes, is that the microscope's on them. They need to be a lot more careful, and they have the resources to do it. And just as far as, like you said, I handle a lot of drinking and driving offenses, a lot of driving related offenses for professional athletes. it's so easy to hire a driver. It's so easy to take Uber. It's so easy to do something else.
You know what I always say, Jeff, the first thing I would do if I had all the money in the world, I would never drive a car again. I would have a driver.
As much as I love cars, I agree with you on
that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd still like my cars, but I would not be the one driving it, especially if I'm out and about. But is there something, and again, this is not to be disparaging, and you can't really paint the whole group of athletes together, but is there something about these athletes that lead them to get into trouble more? And when I say trouble, I might mean they're getting them sued or getting divorced or having criminal problems. Is there some perfect storm here that's going on?
I think a lot of them are young and they have access to a lot of money and they have a lot of peer pressure also. And it definitely exists. For example, when certain athletes might be on, you know, and their teammates are going to know usually and the public generally knows because it has hit the media, but when they're charged with a crime. But what they don't all necessarily know is the bond conditions they have to abide by or the probation conditions that they have to abide by. And so sometimes they feel awkward to tell them that or to whatever. So if they're at an away game, they're going to have a drink, and that's an automatic violation. And that just creates a whole other case in and of itself to be able to fight the violation.
It just seems to me that teams might actually hire somebody to kind of bodyguard them. I mean, not just bodyguard, but tell them that they can't do this and kind of hang out with them to make sure they stay on track because, again, having a conviction or a violation of probation could mean all kinds of loss to the team.
And I'm a huge advocate of that, and talking to general counsels of a lot of the sports teams and a lot of the managers is to really stress on their players to, you know, to have drivers, to do certain things, to stay out of trouble, to raise awareness among the leagues.
So I just have one little quick story. There was a story this week I was asked to comment on the Steve Cochran show. It was a basketball player playing in some kind of league in Virginia. I don't know exactly. It was an adult league. And there was a hard foul during the game, and he did what any athlete would do after he was fouled. He called 911 and he reported it to the police. And it brought up an interesting question, which is, can you commit a crime while you're on the court?
Well, I think they're tough cases, and I don't think prosecutors really want to bring those cases. They're tough cases to prove. I don't really see cases like that going anywhere far.
Well, I mean, you consent to certain things that happen on the court. Like, you know, if you're playing hockey, you consent to being thrown into the boards and being tackled if you're playing football. But I just thought that was an interesting case because it seems to me, you know, actually, I do see some of them in the Little League realm, where you occasionally see someone suing or being prosecuted for doing something that's kind of outrageous. But I think that's more with the children.
And even those are very tough cases. I've been approached about some of those cases, and they're just really, really tough cases.
And it's like Mike Tyson biting off someone's ear. Now, if that's not actionable, what is, right? All right. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us. And by the way, I know that your website lists you as being one of the best-dressed attorneys in all of the state. And I have to say, you're looking very dapper tonight.
Thank you.
It's always good to look good as a lawyer, right?
Absolutely. It's important. You know, everything we do, we've got to pay a lot of attention and detail, and I think it's important that we do that with our wardrobe as well.
I always say, I don't want the judge to say, who's the defendant and who's the lawyer, right?
Ooh.
Jeff, if someone wants to contact you, how would they get in touch with you?
Best way, my phone number is 248-549-0000. We're based out of Michigan. We have offices throughout the country. Our website is aboudlaw.com.
And you can always contact me, Karen Conti, and I can put you in touch with Jeff. Thank you so much for joining us. And when we come back, we're going to be taking your legal calls, 312-981-7200. Well, this is the time of my show where I take your legal calls on any legal topic you might have. I'll try to do my best to give you an answer or try to steer you in the right direction. When I give you an answer, it's not like I'm giving you exact legal advice because, of course, I don't know all of your facts and I don't know everything about your situation, but hopefully it will help you and maybe some other listeners who have similar types of questions. Our number here, and we're going to get to all of you tonight, I think, 981-7200, 312-981-7200. 800-200 or text to that same number. And I'm just going to say that if you do not want to speak on the air, or if you have something that you'd like to discuss in a little more detail, give me a call at my office. You can leave a message on a private line, and that's 312-332-7800. Or better yet, send me an email with some details. Not too many details, but when it happened, where you live, what you're looking for, and what your issues are. And that email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com, K-A-R-E-N, Conti, C-O-N-T-I, wgn@askkarenconti.com. But let's get right to the lines. Jeanette. Hi, Jeanette. Welcome
to WGN. I'm so excited about talking with you. I hope I get all my facts straight.
That's okay. All right. Just take your time. Relax. We're all good. You're only listening. Only like 100,000 people are listening, so it's okay.
Thanks.
Okay.
Okay. This involves a situation in Kendall County. My ex-daughter-in-law is very vindictive. She was ruled unfit by the court, so she only has visitation rights for the minor child. She started to do orders of protection against my son, the custodial parent. The judge told her to stop doing that. So now she is filing charges with DCFS for abuse, including sexual abuse. Over the last 3 years, she has filed 5 charges, which have proved to be unfounded. Now she's going after the family dog. So she has animal control and the police involved. And the dog is not hurting anything. What can we do to stop her or punish her from doing this? She's just being mean and vindictive.
Jeanette, this is it's not a common problem, but I have seen it. And let me just say again, I'm going to just give a little bit of insight and wisdom from doing this for 31 years. There are people like this woman who have mental problems, and she has either a personality disorder of some type, or she has something going on that she cannot let this go, and it's her child. So you understand why she's angry, but what she's doing is not helping her cause, and is going to get her in trouble. Generally speaking, what I advise people to do is to go back into the family law court and advise the judge exactly of what you said to me, and advise the court that she made false accusations to the DCFS, to the police, to the animal control, all of those places, and to say that she's doing this, and this is harmful not only to your son but to the child, because that's obviously going to be harmful to the child. And the thing that the family law courts try to preserve and try to protect most is not the parties, but the child. That's their first priority. And the judge can issue an order to her barring her from doing these things without getting prior consent. So that it's a very unusual remedy, but the judge has the authority to say, if her name is Jane cannot call the police, or she cannot make a report on in any governmental agency at other like, unless and until she goes to court and asks for leave to do that. And if she does that, then what you have is you have the ability to hold her in contempt. And when she violates the order, which she will do, I will guarantee you, given your representations here, if they're absolutely what you're saying is true, then she's going to violate, I predict, and then you go into court and you hold her in contempt. In that case, actually, the judge has the authority to throw her in jail. And the judge has the authority to fine her, but fining someone is not like throwing someone in jail. And I have seen this happen, and this might just get her to stop. Okay, so that's your best bet. And if you want to talk about it further, give me a call at the office. I actually have a good lawyer up in McHenry who I use to do my family law cases, and that person might be a good reference for you. Okay, Jeanette?
Well, we do have lawyers involved over the last 5 years. It costs us a lot of money.
I'm sure.
But we are pursuing this. I mean, we have to.
Good luck.
I mean, it's a matter of family security.
No, you're right, because if she has the capability of doing these things, then she might have the capability of doing things that are even more harmful physically and otherwise. But thank you for the call, Jeanette. All right, our number here, 312-981-7200. Let's go to Corey from the Hinsdale area. Hi, Corey.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for all you teach us.
Thank
I have
you.
A question to ask. Is there anything that we can do about junk phone calls that we receive on our home or our cell phone. It always appears that the call, that the phone number they're coming from is our same area code and the same exchange. It's just the last four numbers that are different, almost giving us the impression that it's a neighbor or someone nearby or something like that. And it's always a robocall, always trying to sell us, you know, some kind of product or service, or telling us we just want a cruise or something like that. I'm very conscientious about who we give our number out to. If I buy something on the internet and it's like a one-time thing, I won't give them my regular number. I won't give them somebody else's number, but I'll give them a number that's obviously not a real number, like 555-555-5555.
Right.
Is there anything we can do about this?
You know,
because I'm sure that, and I use the call block feature on our phone, but an hour later or the next day, we'll get the same kind of phone call with the same kind of product.
So
and I'm sure
help.
I'm not the only one who receives this. Is there anything we can do?
And Corey, you know what? I looked this up several years ago for somebody who had the same issue, and I'm going to have to do that again because I can't put my finger on what exactly it is, but there is something you can do. There are laws that protect, and you can actually report this conduct, and they will stop it. They will fine the people from doing it if it violates the law. But here's what you need to do, and again, I'm sorry, I don't recall exactly what the law is. I don't recall exactly the resource that you need to contact, but send me an email. I'll remember you, and I will give you an answer back, and I will talk about it next time I'm on the air so that everyone will have that resource available.
And I have already registered under, like, the Do Not Call Registry and all those kinds of places, but it does not seem to help.
Interesting. All right, let me look into it, and if there's another resource I have to make that determination. But give me an email, and I'll give you that address. Is WGN@AskKarenConti.com. WGN@AskKarenConti.com. I'm going to get to all of your calls. I have David on hold. I hope you can hold through the break. And I'm taking all of your legal questions. Or if you have a question about a news story, legal news story or otherwise, I will happy to weigh in. 981-7200 or text to that same number. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Call me about a legal news story. Call me about any news story. Call me about your legal questions or anything you might have been pondering, and I'm going to give you my office number in case you want to reach out to me there, 312-332-7800 or WGN@AskKarenConti.com. Let's go to the lines. David, hi. Thanks for waiting. What is your legal question?
Oh, thank you for being lawyer user friendly. I have a son, age 34, lives in San Diego, met his high school girlfriend in Boston. They became engaged 2 years ago, and then a year ago they had a child out of wedlock. And the details are very undetailed. The girlfriend, i.e. fiance, decided to go back to Boston with the baby via a text message, leaving my son basically stripped. So I have very limited details, so I just wanted to know the legalities of that type of transition across state lines. And I can't give you more details on that because the situation is very silent.
Sure. No, I understand. And I'm not going to give you specific advice. Even though I am a member of the California Bar, I would probably have to go and look up exactly what the law is. But generally speaking, David, the law is very similar throughout the 50 states, that when you have a child with someone, it doesn't matter if you're married. You have a child with someone, to leave the state without consent is probably a violation of the law. Okay?
Okay.
Now, I don't know how long ago this happened. I don't know the exact details. I don't know if the time has passed. I'm not sure on the exact law in California at this juncture.
Well, it happened once ago in the original court decision was the child was a resident of California. That's where it's at. So it lies there.
Okay. And generally speaking, what you do is you file a petition, and what happens is the judge in California will get on the phone with the judge in the jurisdiction where the child is, and they have a talk, and they make a determination as to whether the child has to be transported back to the home state. And generally speaking, that's what happens. So there is an interstate law that helps this, and so there are mechanisms to get the child back. I just don't know exactly what the time limits are. I don't know the terms here, but but the best advice that I have is to get a very, very good family law lawyer in the San Diego area who knows about this Uniform Custody Act that is relevant to this issue, so that he or she can get you your son to get the child back. Because otherwise, the child's going to grow up without a dad if one's living on one coast and he's living on another. Okay.
Very good. I think he's on his way. Thanks for a cool show. Thanks.
All right, David. Take care. That's a heart-wrenching situation, and it becomes very expensive. And one of the things that I tell people is that if that you suspect that your significant other or fiance or even wife or husband is going to remove the child to another state, you should do something proactively. In fact, I was just in court this week, and there was a case where the woman was threatening to move to Arizona, and she was selling her house and she was getting ready, and she was telling some people that she was going to go, and then she wasn't going to go, and the judge issued a stop order, said you cannot leave the state, and if you do, it's going to be a violation of the law. It's going to be a violation anyway, but if you do this, you will be held in contempt. I've seen people be thrown in jail for this kind of thing. So, again, if you're the one who wants to leave, don't think that you can just leave. And on the other hand, if you're the one who's being left, you need to take proactive action to make sure you can assert your parental rights, which is in the best interest of the child for the most part. For the most occasions, a child is best raised with both parents in the immediate vicinity. 981-7200, give us a call here. Let's go to Terry in Burbank. Hi, Terry.
Hey, how are you doing, Ms. Conti?
Good. What is your legal question?
Just to be quite succinct and quick with this, so I had a question in regards to Castle Doctrine and other terms of self-defense of yourself and your property. A short while ago, my younger brother, he's 3 years younger than me, he was working on a car on the street right in front of our house, opposite side from our house. A male sped down our block. It's 20 miles an hour. The speed limit is, he was going probably 40, 45 miles an hour. Judging by the tire slick he left from slamming on the brakes, my younger brother yelled at him because we have many small children that live on our block. And, they got in a heated argument. Suffice to say, my younger brother got behind his car, walking back, and the male in the vehicle slammed it in the reverse and attempted to run my younger brother over. He got out of the way in time. I own a firearm. I've got a Floyd card. I understand the Floyd card is not entitled me legally to leave my property with a firearm. But in the self-defense of others, would I have been justified in having a fire on the male in his vehicle or not?
Generally speaking, I think the answer is going to be no. The Castle Doctrine applies really to your home, and in some cases it has applied to your car. So if you're in your car and you're defending your right to be there, defending the rights of others is not something that most people have the right to do unless it's going to be something imminent and it's severe bodily harm. So after the fact, doing something by taking your gun out and chasing him or trying to shoot him is probably not legal.
I would not have pursued him otherwise, but he actually bumped into my brother, which proceeded, or actually he made my brother move out of the way. I would not have been just, I didn't fire my gun, obviously. You would have heard it on the news, but right. I'm just saying, though, if he would have kept on going after my younger brother and moving vehicle, which is a deadly weapon, I would have been justified without having a concealed carry permit in opening fire on him in defense of the life of others or not.
You might have a right to do that, and you might win a criminal case on that one if you were charged, or maybe the police would not charge you, the prosecutors would not charge you. But if you didn't have a concealed carry, you could be charged with having you know, using the gun outside of the home. So
unlawful use.
So, you know, you walk down that road and, you know, there are a lot of prosecutors who will prosecute gun crimes in cases like this. And there are some who feel strongly, hey, this guy was wrong. You had a right to defend your brother. I'm not going to do anything about it. But I guess, you know, the best advice is to be safe and to not do that. If it's after the fact, that's different. If it's to prevent the incident from happening, if there was a top point in time where you saw him backing up and you knew that if you didn't shoot him, he would have run your brother over.
Obviously, I had my pistol leveled at him from the front door while I was still inside of the house. I'm not sure if he saw me or not. That didn't really factor, but he got immediately sped off afterwards.
You know,
all the police report, nothing came of it.
I'm not going to tell you that I'm an expert on these laws because they're very different in different states. And
castle doctrine is really difficult.
It is difficult, but in different jurisdictions, it's interpreted differently. In Texas and Florida, it's interpreted much more broadly than it is, say, in Illinois. But I think that one of the things that is really helpful to do is to go online and learn as much about Illinois law as you can about what is justified and what is not. And even if you get your concealed carry, which you probably should do. And I've taken, my husband took the concealed carry class. There's all kinds of little, they run through scenarios. What would you do in this situation? And it sort of grooms you to do the right thing. Again, I think you should be always looking up those laws and always anticipating what would I do if someone did the following to make sure that you don't end up on the other side of the court table as a defendant, because that's the last thing you want.
Okay. Right. Well, I'm former military, so my immediate thought was to go out and loss of life. And
yeah.
We ended up okay. But, all right, Ms. Conti, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your call, Terry. Thank you so much. I want to talk a little bit, I have a few minutes here. I get the question all the time about what happens when my ex-spouse stops paying child support. I'm just going to give you a quick little lesson in what to do, or if you have somebody in your family who's not getting child support, and if you're not paying child support for some reason, you need to listen to this too, because you're going to know what happens in the event that you're violating a court order. First, you have to decide who's going to help you. Are you going to do this yourself? Are you going to hire a private lawyer? The other option, besides those two options, is to get together with the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. There is a Child Support Enforcement Division in Cook County, and there are similar types of divisions in other counties. They will take on your case, and they will file against your spouse to obtain an order to get them to comply with child support. Okay, they won't deal with custody, they won't deal with visitation and parenting time, we call it now, but they will establish paternity if you're not married, and they will get a child support order or modify or enforce a child support order. So that's one avenue you have. The downside with doing that is that the state's attorney's office is very busy, and so they don't always get to these things as quickly as a private lawyer, but you don't have to pay, which is the upside. You can do it on your own. You can file papers in the clerk's office. Generally speaking, if you want to do this on your own, I suggest that you go to the clerk's office in the county where your divorce occurred or where you live, and you file petitions to hold your spouse in contempt. You have to file a motion, draft a motion, file it, serve him with it. I'll say him, but it could be her. And doing this on your own is hard. You have to miss work. You have to know what you're doing. The judges hold you to the same rules that they hold lawyers to. And it's kind of nerve-wracking. If I were a pro se, we call it pro se, which means without a lawyer, a litigant, it's nerve-wracking because you don't know what's happening and you have to stand before the court. And you may not know exactly how to go about doing it. So if you have a lot of money that's owed to you, I suggest you hire a lawyer. And generally, the law provides that if your ex is violating a child support order, you are entitled to your attorney's fees at the end of it. That means that you probably would pay a lawyer up front, and your lawyer would eventually ask for compensation for all the fees that you incurred in trying to get the order. One of the things, though, that you have to be careful of is, let's just say that your ex is kind of a deadbeat, doesn't work, doesn't really have any assets. It's one thing to get an order. It's another thing to enforce it. And I have to say that I am not pleased with the way most judges enforce the orders. They rarely take away a driver's license. They rarely throw people in jail. But it's always a very difficult process if you've got someone who's decided that they don't want to pay child support for one reason or another. On the other hand, if there are people out there who aren't paying support and haven't done it for years, you could be in for some trouble. You can go to jail. The judge can say if you don't come up with a certain amount of dollars, you're going to go to jail. And you can have your license taken away, and you can have your tax refund taken away. So these are things that you shouldn't let sit there. You should move on them. You should make sure you assert your rights one way or the other. And I hope this little lesson helped. If you have any more questions, you can always give me a call at my office, 312-332-7800, or better yet, email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com. We're going to take a break, but I have the phone lines open. We have a good half an hour left for legal questions. Our number's here, 312-981-7200, or text to that same number. You're listening to WGN. We're still taking your legal calls, any topic that you have, something you've heard in the news you want to talk about, some indictment, some lawsuit that is of interest to you, give us a call here. We'd love to hear from you, 312-981-7200. Let us go to Kathy in scenic Bolingbrook. Hi, Kathy. How are you?
Hi, Karen. Good, thanks. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Back in the day, there was a company called Glamour Shots, and it would do photo shoots, and you'd be made up and look all pretty, and you could take, you know, pictures. You're very familiar with that, I
would
think.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Well, I guess Glamour Shots is out of business, but there are other companies that still do that. And I, for my husband's birthday back in April, it was recommended to me a specific photographer. I contacted him. He said, oh, there's someone planning a photo shoot for me in Indiana, in the northern suburbs of Indiana, and she would do the makeup, she would do the setup, and he would take the photos. I scheduled it in March. I went up there. On the day of the shoot, she canceled by email. She said she was ill, and she would hold the deposit for a future shoot. I let her know it was very difficult for me. I mean, this was for a specific reason, specific time period. The travel time was too difficult for me. It's too long a distance. I'm actually currently living in southern Indiana, so it's 6 hours away.
Oh, my gosh.
So I told her, I cannot do another photo shoot. It's very inconvenient. I understand you were ill, but please refund my deposit as a result. Now, she did have a writer that said deposits were non-refundable, but my understanding is that's to protect the business against clients who cancel for no reason, not to protect her when she cancels.
So the question is, they're not giving you your money back, and you want to know
what she didn't. Right. Okay. I wanted to call. I was going to contact the business, Better Business Bureau. I was going to contact the state's attorney. I find out she lives in Chicago, but apparently she does business in both states. So do I contact the state's attorney of Illinois or Indiana? Because the business was supposed to be done in Indiana.
Okay, Kathy, I'm going to answer your question. I'm going to put you on hold. The first thing you do in a case like this is to look at the contract and what it says. And generally speaking, that should spell out what your rights are. So you're right. It says that the deposit is not refundable. But the question is, did they breach the contract by canceling? Or is there some idea that it's reasonable that it can be canceled and then rescheduled to another time? I'd have to look at the exact language of that contract to determine what your rights are, if any. Okay, that said, and that's just the legal part of it, is as to the criminal part, no state's attorney is going to prosecute a company for doing that. Just they're not. This is a civil matter. The state's attorneys have murders and other things to deal with, so they're really not going to be interested in this. Certainly, you can call the Better Business Bureau. You can do Yelp. You can do all that kind of stuff. But what you really want is your money back. So what I would do is I would write a letter, an email to the company or the person, whoever you were dealing with, and say, this is what happened. I live 6 hours away. Put it in writing. I want my money back. I don't want to disparage your company, or I don't want to criticize your company. But if I will, if I have to, I will, because this should not happen to somebody. This was of no fault of my own. You breached the contract. You can use those words by canceling, and you didn't cancel ahead of time. You canceled in a way that harmed me, and I deserve my money back. And if not, you know, I'm going to go online and do what I have to do to notify other consumers that you did wrong. Again, let me say this, because I've given this advice before as well. Be careful what you say on Yelp. Be careful what you say on the Better Business Bureau and all these other sites, because I don't think you're going to get sued if you say something, but why do you want to run the risk of that? Defending a lawsuit could cost tens of thousands of dollars. And just remember, what you say has to be true. You can't lie about anything. And if you say something false, that's when you're going to get sued, or that's the potential lawsuit. If you say they're a company that doesn't do a good job, or they've got bad practices, or you tell them this is what happened, they canceled at the last minute and they won't refund my money, which is the truth, then you're probably okay, and you probably don't have anything to worry about. On the other hand, and I keep going back and forth on this, I have seen businesses become very angry at consumer reporting, and they have sued the consumer, even though they're in the wrong. So again, I don't know how much was at stake. If it's a few hundred dollars, is it worth it to get sued over? Is it worth it to spend your time on it? I understand why you're angry. I very much understand that. That's bad business, you know, and they should reschedule. They should come to you and take the picture. So that would have pleased you, and that would have been good customer service, but they didn't choose to do that. And that's unfortunate. I hope that helps. I hope that, that resolves your problem, or at least sends you in the right direction. Give us a call here, 981-7200, any legal question you might have. Let's go to Billy in Joliet. Hi, Billy.
Hey, how you doing, Karen? I love your show.
Thank you.
Hey, listen, I was just wondering, the issue of unlicensed cars with for sale signs on them. Where I live, there's many strip malls. I think some guy's running a little used car lot, you know, one or two cars, no license plate, in a public parking spot, you know, the for sale sign. I've even called the village saying, well, wait a second, how can you park an unlicensed car in a public place? So I understand if you're in a private driveway or something, that's different. And I know the police probably don't want to be bothered with it, since there's no plate. They can't run the plate. They can't find out who owns the car. They probably have to go find a VIN number or something. But isn't there, I mean, how can you sit there and park a car in a public place with no license plate? Isn't it against the law to drive a car without a license plate?
Yeah.
Or just leave it somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, generally you're right. And I'm not sure why no one's doing anything about it. But again, I think we have the issue of the police and the prosecutors and people who are enforcing laws have a lot of things going on. They have a lot of crime, and they have a lot of things, and so maybe they don't want to chase this down, and they see that there's no harm to it. But, you know, you're right. I have seen police, even in driveways, I've seen people, police come and say, you know, there's no license plate on this car. There needs to be a plate. So, I don't know. I'm just curious. Is there some reason why that bothers you?
Well, it just junks up the neighborhood. You know, you drive down the street and you see three cars with for sale signs, you know, bike signs, and this really looks junky. I'm thinking, hey, if this is Wilmette or something, I don't think that would be allowed. I mean,
you know, you're right about that. I understand your concern. It's not like you're playing vigilante because you don't like people violating the law. It just kind of cheapens your neighborhood and makes it look. Yeah, makes it look not as nice. That's what you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, I always say, you know, if you know any of your politicians, your aldermen, or anyone in your village or your town or your community, maybe you give them a call and you say that maybe it's affecting our property values and it looks bad and he's violating the law. See if you can do something about it. I bet that's a good way to deal with it.
Okay, thank you,
all right. Good luck, Billy.
Bye-bye.
Take care. You've got 15 minutes left, and you can make good use of that by giving me a call. Happy to help you with your legal issues on any question you might have. 312-981-7200. This is Karen Conti on WGN. 800-981-7200. We got a few text calls here, but our phone lines are open. If you want to talk to me at the office, I'm happy to do that. 312-332-7800. That's a private line, so you can leave me a detailed message. And please leave me some details. Don't just say, this is John Smith, call me back, because I don't know how to respond, and I get very busy, and I'm not too busy to call you back. But if you give me some specific facts about what you want, who you are, where you are, when things happen, what you expect, that is very, very helpful to me, because then I will be able to get you the information you need as quickly as I can. You can also email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com. We have a texter from 773. When an insurance company makes their first offer for personal injury, on average, what percentage will they increase before going to arbitration? And that's Ed. Hi, Ed. Thank you for the text. I get this question or similar question very often. What happens is, and I'm just going to make up the story, I assume this is a car accident where the insurance company is going to pay, but what they're going to do is, yeah, they're going to try to negotiate down what you're entitled to. If your property damage is $3,000 and you have an estimate for $3,000, they're going to try to pay you $2,200 or $2,000, and they're going to try to force you into hiring a lawyer to assert your rights. And it's hard to find a lawyer to assert rights for $2,000, which is not a lot in the scheme of litigation. It's a lot to anyone, but it's not a lot to hire a lawyer. So there's really, I don't have a percentage that I say that there's a rule of thumb. I just say that you can spend the time going to arbitration. You can do all of that stuff. I think you just need to paper the file as best you can. I think you need to get three estimates if that's the case, and tell them that you're not asking for the most expensive one. You're asking for the one in the middle, and put it in writing. And you might even say, you're operating in bad faith. This is bad faith. This is a legitimate claim. There you have no reason to pay me less. And you can tell them that you're consulting with a lawyer if you don't get what you want. See what'll happen. And again, it's not worth getting a lawyer, but certainly that is something you can threaten to do if the insurance company is not behaving correctly. And I have gotten in trouble from my listeners by saying this, because I have represented insurance companies over the years. And, you know, listen, they try to save their money. They know you don't have a lawyer. They know it's expensive to hire a lawyer. And they don't, you know, companies don't have a conscience, as Ralph Nader used to say. And so, therefore, they're going to try to save you money. And so I think that you have to keep that in mind. And maybe you're not going to get all every dollar that you're entitled to. And then you're going to know, if it's your own insurance company, switch insurance companies, because they should be doing the right thing to keep their business. Another texter from the 224 area code says, 30 years ago, my mom had ovarian cancer. She did not die from it, but years later, she did end up dying from cancer. I specifically remember my mom being a heavy user of Johnson & Johnson's talcum powder. Is there anything legally that we can do, or is this past the time that we're allowed to do anything? Well, as you probably know, you have followed the news. There have been some huge verdicts in suits regarding this. And some of them have been successful, and those are the ones you hear about. And some of them have been lost. So there are all kinds of verdicts out there, but there are lawyers who take these cases. And it would be best to have the lawsuit brought as a class action, and you can join those class actions by finding the lawyers who are handling those cases. And really, you can just Google. This day and age is Google class action for talcum powder cases. The question is always going to be proving that your mother used talcum powder, how she used it, how often did she use it, and what the brand was. And that's not that it's impossible to prove, but you're going to have some proof issues. It's obviously better if, you know, she were alive, because then she could testify about it herself. But you would have to be able to document, and not document, but to testify about all of these facts, and about, you know, like I said, how she used it and how much she used it, so that you can prove that there's a causal connection. So if you need help in finding a class action lawyer, I can help you do that if you'd like. WGN@askkarenconti.com. Let's go to the phone lines in Prairie, Wisconsin. Hi, welcome to WGN. Hello? No? I don't hear. Nope. Nope. Not him. Okay. There's another texter that had an interesting question. Let me go and let me see what he's going to say here. My father passed away a few weeks ago and left everything in his estate to my sister and I. My aunt is the executor, and since he has passed, there are some sentimental items that I'd like. I'm not sure how to stop without starting a war. Oh, he's already laid claim to items and has let others come in and take the items as well as donate it. Okay, I'm mixing this up. So basically, they're giving away some of the items, and she doesn't care about the financial end, but there's some sentimental things that she wants to put her hands on. So the question is, what did the will or the trust say about those personal possessions? Did they go to you and your sister? And are they being given to people other than you and your sister? If that's the case, then the executor is not doing her job. If your aunt is allowing people to take things other than the beneficiaries to the trust or the will, then you need to assert your rights and say, listen, do not give these things away. These belong to us. You have a right to assert your interest as a beneficiary. And you can remind her that an executor has what we call fiduciary duties. And look that up, fiduciary, F-I-D-U-C-I-A-R-Y. That means that she owes a duty to the estate, and she owes a duty to the beneficiaries of the estate to do the highest possible care, to use the highest possible care in doing what she's doing, which is disseminating, gathering the assets and disseminating them to the beneficiaries. And she is actually violating her duties by giving away those personal items. So, you know, if they're that serious to you and really that important to you, you can actually claw them back, meaning you can actually hire a lawyer to file a motion to claw them back. We call that a citation. And that citation would bring in that third party to demand that those items be given back to the estate and therefore given to you. So that's my best advice. I hope that helps. We have another texter for 815. She says, or he says, why not file a small claim for an insurance problem under $5,000? Yeah, I mean, you could do that. You could sue your insurance carrier. It depends on how much is at stake and how much time you want to spend doing this. But let's just say that you're only $500 apart. You certainly do not want to bring a small claim for $500. I just don't. I can't imagine that it would be worth anyone's time to spend what it costs to file the claim. It costs a couple hundred dollars. I don't know what the current rate is to file a small claim, to go to the courthouse, to spend the money on a sheriff, to have it served, to go back to court, to maybe go to court four or five times, to have stand in front of the judge, to get a verdict, get a judgment. It's a lot of work to take off and to park and to do all those things. I personally wouldn't suggest that, but, you know, this says if it's under $5,000. If it's $5,000, yeah, maybe that is a good way to assert your rights without hiring a lawyer. So thank you for the text, and that's a good point. And let's see, we have, what else do we have? Oh, let's see. We have a suggestion from a listener who was listening to the issue of the gentleman who had was complaining about these cars being for sale in a strip mall who didn't have license plates. It says, I'm a building official in one of the suburbs, and I'd be happy to talk with you. I'm going to give out his number, 708-372-6945. And he said that abandoned vehicles, weeds, and junk are usually handled by the code enforcement property maintenance inspectors, usually a function of the building department. So that's a good idea. So I suggested going to your politician, but maybe you go into the building department of your municipality. I think you said you were from Joliet. So maybe you go there, and that's a person that would take the interest in doing that and getting rid of those cars for sale. Let's see. Do you still have time to get a few calls in? But we're really running out of time. I wanted to just quickly talk about this issue with Michael Cohen, who is President Trump's former attorney. I'm not going to get political, so don't freeze up here. But the idea was that there were taped conversation between Michael Cohen and Donald Trump, and President Trump said,